Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Josh Riedel, author of the new novel, Please Report Your Bug Here, from Henry Holt. Josh graduated from Portland's Reed College as an English major, then moved to the Bay Area to work at Facebook in its early days. Josh left Facebook to join a startup that was acquired by Facebook soon after, left again to become the first employee at Instagram, which, guess what, was also acquired by Facebook. Then left the tech world entirely to earn his MFA from the University of Arizona. His short stories have appeared in One Story, Joyland, and Passages North, among others. Josh currently lives in San Francisco, which has not yet been acquired by Facebook. Please Report Your Bug Here is Josh's first published novel, and it had me hooked from the very first pages. Helen Phillips calls the book a Silicon Valley gumshoe story that's also a meditation, an authenticity and connection in a world ever more mediated by technology. In this riveting and surreal debut, Josh Riedel explores the labyrinthine mysteries of big tech and of the human heart. Please join us for our conversation with Josh Riedel, which is already in progress. Josh, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about your own story first, since that was a big inspiration for the novel. You and I are fellow Reedies attending Reed College here in Portland, a generation apart. Though unlike me, you graduated with a degree in English Lit, and you took several creative writing classes there. How'd you go from Reed to working in high tech in the Bay Area? And I know you have acknowledgments in the book to both people who influenced you at Reed, Peter Rock and Natalia King.
Yeah, that's right. So Peter Rock, when I was at Reed, and was the writing professor, like the one fiction writer there. And I believe he still is, though I think they bring in visiting professors here and there. And I took my first creative writing classes with Peter Rock my sophomore, junior years. And then my senior year, Pete was on sabbatical, and it was time for me to write my senior thesis. So at Reed, every senior writes a thesis. And I applied to write a creative thesis, which is a little bit, you know, a couple of people a year might do it at Reed. And I was able to write that thesis with Natalia King, who's a professor of literature at Reed. And every week I got to go in and read aloud to Natalia what I'd written. And she'd give me feedback, and we'd talk about my work as though it was, you know, published writing. And so it was my first experience, like a taste of being, of having my writing read seriously. And I knew, like, I loved that feeling, and I knew I wanted to continue writing, but I also needed a job because I had a lot of student loan debt from going to Reed. So I heard about a friend who was also an English major at Reed, who'd moved down to Palo Alto and started working at Facebook. And Facebook, I used for about 3 years. It came out my sophomore year at Reed. And a few years later, I graduated and I heard about people going to work at this company. And I thought that sounded pretty interesting. For me, the internet, you know, like I was an English major, so I wasn't going down there to code. So a lot of people at the time were kind of like, why would you go work at a tech company? It wasn't as common as it is today for people who aren't trained in computer science or design to go and work at these companies. But I was always fascinated by the internet. Like, I'm that generation that, you know, when I was really young, wasn't really, and the internet wasn't as accessible in households. But when I was probably before I was a teenager, you know, we had a computer in our house, and then we had, you know, a dial-up modem and
AOL.
We could connect to AOL, and I discovered, you know, LiveJournal and MySpace and stuff like that. So I always thought of the internet as a way to connect me to people outside of my little world of Missouri that I grew up in. And so to move down to Silicon Valley after finishing at Reed just sounded really exciting to me. And I think I needed a paycheck, but I also thought this work could be something that's just different. It wasn't just taking a traditional office job. It was a bunch of people around my age who were building this thing that millions of people in the world were using, and I wanted to be a part of that.
And you have a character in the book who actually says she grew up on the internet and now it's our turn to shape it. I think you must have felt the same way.
Exactly. Yeah, that really speaks to some of my motivations for going down there. I felt like it was very, I'm still very optimistic about technology, but
it's harder now than it was in 2010 or so.
Yeah, I think there's just like a lot more public knowledge about how especially like big tech companies make money and there's trust issues. But I think as a college graduate moving down there and working with all of these people who had kind of the grand hopes for how we could connect with people all across the world using the internet, that was really inspiring to me. And I really held on to that through my 20s, like working in technology.
And you went from Facebook, you took a year or so off teaching in Thailand.
In
Vietnam English. You eventually ended up in Instagram and you're billed as the first employee there. They're two founders, Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger. How did you get there? They were friends of yours?
Yeah, so I actually, after I came back from teaching in Vietnam, I started working at a small startup that built a travel website. And there were two founders and then two other employees. And one of the employees was Kevin Systrom, who ended up starting Instagram. And so we became friends at that job. And I stayed, Kevin left about 6 months into my being there and to start his own project, which, you know, he didn't know would be Instagram yet. And a few months after he left, Facebook acquired Next Stop, the company I was working for. So I was out of a job.
They seem like they're following you around because eventually Instagram, it's no spoiler alert, Instagram was also acquired by Facebook.
Right. So I worked at Facebook in 2007. They acquired the startup I went to work for in 2009, and then they acquired Instagram in 2012. So after the travel website was acquired, I asked Kevin, hey, whenever your company launches, I'd be really interested in working with you again. Because I just found that he was a very creative thinker, very determined, and I really enjoyed working with him. And so once, I was beta testing the app that would become Instagram at the time. And so once Instagram launched in October 2010, I was actually in Portland applying to grad school, applying to MFA programs in creative writing when Instagram launched. And Kevin called me up, I think the week it launched, and said, hey, you still want to help out? I think this thing's really taking off.
I recently read an article you wrote for Slate Magazine on your alias there, which is just Josh, @Josh, and kind of the advantages and drawbacks of having it. I think you recently changed it. What was the reason for that? You didn't want all the attention that went with that?
Exactly. Yeah. I tried to change it about a year ago and the Instagram system wouldn't let me change it. And I thought it was just some technical issue where an old account or something, like they couldn't change the username on it. But I wrote this essay for Slate documenting kind of, I thought of it as like my the last 10 years on the internet, like an essay, a personal essay about my last 10 years on the internet, having the handle @Josh, and seeing over the years how much of a valuable commodity that became. Like when I signed up, I was just like, oh, it'd be cool to have my first name. But especially in the last few years, I had a lot of kind of unwanted attention. Like I got a lot of messages from people wanting to buy the name, wanting to trade me things for the name. And I just had no interest in that. And once this essay published, I should have guessed this, but I got a lot more attention for the name. And so that day, I just decided to change it to the Josh Riedel.
And Instagram at that point allowed you to change it.
There's some mysterious things happening behind the scenes there, I think, because I swear I tried to change it before and it wouldn't let me. And I even tried changing it to a username I knew for sure was available and it wouldn't let me. But then that day it did. So there's some mysterious forces behind these companies.
Now, we mentioned that Instagram was acquired by Facebook, and that was in 2014. I think you left in 2016 or so, to go to an MFA program at the University of Arizona. So you left that tech bro culture of San Francisco, kind of the center of the tech universe, for life in Tucson. I know you're a coffee aficionado from reading the book. I'm sure the coffee wasn't as good there, but that must have been quite a culture shock.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the coffee in Tucson, it kind of reminds me of early 2000s Portland when Stumptown was around.
Oh,
and
yes.
That was like the one, you know, third wave coffee shop that was really kind of like promoting that kind of coffee in Portland. And moving to Tucson, there's Cartel Coffee and Presta Coffee. And it really reminded me of these like early days of Portland coffee when Stumptown was around. And then I think Hart came and others, but Kova. But it was a culture shock more so in just like my relationship with time. Because I was coming from the tech world where I was convinced that, you know, I think I'd just been trained to think like we can do anything in 6 weeks. Like, I think we set a goal to launch video on Instagram in 6 weeks and achieved it, you know, and then you just iterate after that. And even the way of, you know, existing within a corporate environment at Facebook, and now Meta, you know, I took these 30-minute meetings or one-hour meetings. And I remember moving to Tucson, and the first person I met was another graduate student. She'd already been there for a year. And we met up in a cafe at like 2:30 on a Monday. And I remember having this feeling like I realized I had this internal clock when it hit 30 minutes, where I was kind of like, okay, are we going to wrap this up now? And she just kept talking. And I was like, okay, I guess this is an hour-long meeting. And it went beyond an hour. And I was just so unfamiliar with that it felt like I'd entered into this other universe, like that I was in the high desert in Tucson, Arizona, talking to people about books with no real structure, with no time limits. And so just that shift from the real kind of like focused tech culture to a more kind of like laid back, like artsy environment was a real shock.
And much better for writing, I would assume, than...
I mean, I think there's things that I've taken from my experience in tech where it's helped me with writing. I think having deadlines helps, knowing that you can finish something and then iterate. You know, I took those with me. But yeah, in general, it was nice to have the time and space here in Tucson.
And now let's get directly to the book. Please Report Your Bug Here takes place in San Francisco in 2010. The main character, Ethan Block, is a contractor at a dating app startup called Date Date. He's part of a very small team, just him and the founder of the company, referred to as the founder with a capital F, and a developer referred to as the engineer with a small e. So the book has its roots in your own experience when you were the first employee at Instagram. And you so well describe Ethan's life in San Francisco during that time, what it's like to be immersed in your job, living off Red Bull and granola bars. And there's a great interview you did, Josh, for Bomb Magazine, where you explained your focus on employees like Ethan. You said, "I have a lot to say about tech, but what I cared about most in writing this book was the position of the worker, not the people in tech who get all the airtime, like investors and founders, but the employees who keep the machines running." So you were kind of giving your own experience, but giving a voice also to other people in your same position in this book.
Yeah, that's what I set out to do, and I hope I achieved that. I think a lot of the tech world, when you read about it, is just the focus is so much on the people running the companies and the founders. And, you know, that there's justification for that. But I think we fail to realize that 99% of people who keep the products running that we all use every day, like, don't really have the spotlight on them, and their stories aren't always told. And so I thought of Ethan and his coworker Noma and some other characters at the corporation. You know, I thought of them as people whose stories hadn't been told, and I tried to tell them in this novel.
Yeah, one thing I loved about the book when you're telling those stories, and this got me hooked early on, was the account of working in high tech in the Bay Area at the time among workers like Ethan and Noma and Steph and all the people, you know, the founder, the engineer, both the excitement and the anxiety, the idealism and the desire to make money through high salaries and stock options, at least to pay off your student loans. And I saw that with friends who worked at startups. They thought they were changing the world for the better, they hoped, while waiting for the company to go public. That's a definite theme in the book. Tech is both idealistic and maybe a bit venal.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you have to go into it with a healthy dose of idealism, you know, like to make anything. It's just so hard to make something from scratch. Like, I think you have to go into it with that idealism. I compare it to, like, I always, like, one of the people I worked with at that travel website, one of the founders, knew I was a writer and writing in my spare time. And he was always just like, you know, I see how writing is a lot, writing a book is a lot like building a startup, because in both cases, you're building something from scratch. And I really connected with that statement. I thought that, you know, I could see a lot of similarities there. But there, yeah, you're right. There is a, it's at the end of the day, startups are a business, and novels or paintings, you know, that's art. And so there is a, there's a different kind of like angle taken there. Like when you know this company could potentially go public or even get acquired by a big company.
Yeah, you want to cash in at that point.
Yeah.
And from a very realistic beginning, you know, pretty much depicting very accurately San Francisco at that time in 2010, the story takes a speculative turn when Ethan is briefly transported to another world, maybe due to some kind of bug in the software, but when he can't reproduce. And that starts Ethan on a quest to find out what happened to him and visit that other world one more time. It reminded me of an LA Times article on Helen Phillips, who wrote a very nice blurb for your book. The review called Phillips, quote, a master at building slightly askew worlds that resemble our own. And you've said, Josh, as a fiction writer, I've always gravitated toward the fantastic. When I was younger, I wrote what you could call magical realism. I think spending my 20s working in Silicon Valley shifted my mindset even more toward the speculative. Why was that? Not just reading books by Helen Phillips, and you also mentioned several other writers you're inspired by, like Kelly Link, Haruki Murakami, our own Portland's Karen Russell.
Well, I think the thing about working in tech is that you're just surrounded by all these people who are asking, like, what if, and trying to invent the future. And I was really drawn to that as a writer, like as a creative person. Like, I loved being around like engineers and designers and entrepreneurs who were trying to imagine, you know, like, what are we going to need 5 years from now or 10 years from now? Or what's the world going to look like in the future? And I think just it, living in San Francisco too, like, I know some other writers I admire, like the writer Kate Falk, who wrote the story collection Out There, another San Francisco writer.
And Charles Yu, who you mentioned in the book, I think.
Right. And Charles Yu lived in San Francisco for a while. That I think Kate talks about, like, kind of like living in San Francisco is like you're kind of like this involuntary subject in a big experiment, you know, because like no matter like the self-driving cars are passing by or whatever it is.
Yes.
So you always, you kind of feel like you're living in a slight future compared to, say, like when I went back home to St. Louis. So working in the tech industry and living in San Francisco, just, I think I just defaulted all the time to thinking about what the future looks like. And that just infused itself into my writing. Like, it wasn't even really a conscious thing. Like, I'm going to set out to write about invented technology. It was just kind of like, this is my life. This is what I'm writing about.
Now, about 80 pages into the book, Ethan's startup DateDate is acquired by an insatiable high-tech company, probably based on your experiences with Facebook. It's called the Corporation with a capital C and described as the one company too large to have any competitors. Workers like Ethan are not fond of the corporation, but they pay well, and there are perks, free gourmet food, free dry cleaning, car detailing, on-site doctors, dentists, hairstylists, shuttles to and from work, all free, even an ice cream shop where you can get triple scoops with extra sprinkles. I know that's the reality in tech, or maybe was the reality because it's in a deep recession now. I went through something like that to a much lesser scale when I worked at Microsoft. It always reminded me of Pleasure Island in Pinocchio, kind of luring you in before dropping the boom.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it sounds so great, whatever you list all of that off. I'm like, I wish I had free ice cream whenever I'm writing alone all day. But, you know, these are all tactics to get you to stay at work for longer, you know. So if you have your gym and the place to get your haircut and everything on site, then you can be around and work for longer. In the novel, the corporation is, you know, loosely based on companies like Facebook and Google and Apple. They have their own, like, different ways of, you know,
luring you in.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think like the Pleasure Island example is a great one. You know, it's a great parallel.
It's become somewhat its own genre now in books as well as TV and movies. This, the all-powerful tech company, like the corporation in the book, with a charismatic but amoral, sometimes evil leader. I'm thinking of Dave Eggers' novel, The Circle, TV series Severance and Devs, both of which I loved. And though the high-tech element is relatively new, it comes from our era, of course, of computers and the internet. I've been thinking the story goes back a ways. It's the Frankenstein myth, the legend of the golem, Prometheus in Greek mythology. They all have in common a creation that begins with the best of intentions, but it turns sinister and monstrous. We can see that now with social media, but that wasn't as clear in 2010 when the book takes place. Did you make that connection when you were writing the book several years later, Josh, in 2016?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually just talking to someone about Frankenstein, because I think it's a great, you know, like this idea of like, I'm a huge fan of new inventions and innovation, but I think especially back then, 2010, it seemed like we were so optimistic about just full on optimism about what these new inventions could do. And we weren't thinking far enough ahead about what some of the consequences might be. And I think that definitely changed. I think there's surveys you see that's like in 2015, and then especially in 2016, the public was a lot more informed about how big tech companies make their money. And so using an app like Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, or, you know, we realize like, oh, these aren't just kind of like these, you know, little bits of candy on the screen. There's a corporation behind this, and there's data collection and privacy issues and all of that. And we're a lot more well-informed about that now, which I think is good. And I think, you know, I don't work in the tech industry anymore, but I would hope that it means that the new inventions coming out are, we're thinking a little bit more about the long-term consequences of those.
Now, Ethan starts working at DateDate after a breakup, and he's looking for love, for that perfect match while beta testing the startup's dating app. The app matches users based on compatibility, which is pretty much true, I think, of every dating app. But one character in the book mentions the flaw in that approach. I believe an algorithm matches you with someone based on who you are and who you used to be, not who you will become. Now, you mentioned the British philosopher Alain de Botton in the book. that got me thinking and looking up another quote of his: compatibility is an achievement of love. It shouldn't be its precondition. It seems like Ethan and you, Josh, are on the same page.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page. I think the thing about the dating app in the novel is that even the founder says that it's the dating app is more about learning about yourself, and rather than kind of like matching you, like it promises to match you up with your top match or soulmate, but you have to do a lot of work to get there. And I think the founder's banking on users not really ever doing that. In the founder's mind, his dating app, DateDate, is a way for users to learn about themselves. And that's kind of like a precondition to knowing, you know, who's going to be a compatible person or a soulmate for you.
But also people change. It's almost like you'd need an app that can predict the future, what you're going to be like in 5-10 years. I'm sure that those changes lead to most divorces and breakups.
Right. And I think that's where probably, you know, I could be wrong, but I don't think we're actually going to make an app that can accomplish that. You know, I think this is where you sometimes see where people want to invent some new technology that solves a problem. It's like, well, you know, actually, maybe it would be good for us to just, like, you know, my partner and I, to talk to one another about these issues and grow together. Maybe we don't need to rely on, yeah, exactly. Maybe we don't need an app to tell us, you know, in the next 30 years, I think we're going to be just fine. We're going to grow together compatibly.
Now, Ethan is questing for love, you know, after the breakup, and you've called the novel a coming of age story. He's Ethan in the novel is 24 years old. He's questing not just for the other world he was transported to and the origin of the bug, but his identity. And in one passage I loved, he remembers staying in roadside motels as a kid. This is a quote from the book: "I'd volunteer to get the ice, taking the bucket to the machine down the walkway in the evenings. I would peer into other guests' rooms. I'd linger in front of windows and watch, imagining what it was like to be them, what it would feel like to be someone else. What did it feel like to be me?" And I made the connection. I think, Josh, it seems the other worlds in the book are reflections of ourselves in a way. In fact, Ethan's product manager of the corporation tells him, "The portals lead to different worlds. They vary depending on who you are." And Ethan later says, "I think most of us know deep down that even if we're not a million things, we're still a million other things. Or as Walt Whitman says, I contain multiples." So these other worlds are somewhat of a metaphor for Ethan's questions. What did it feel like to be me?
Yeah, I think that's definitely one way of reading the other worlds. To me, they also, you know, they kind of are made up of Ethan's desires and ideas about himself and who he wants to be. So it is sort of this manifestation of these internal feelings.
Now, Ethan mentions several visual artists in the book, and you're a liberal arts major, so you have a great knowledge of this: painters, photographers, performance artists, poets, musicians. And he makes a connection between art and technology. You know, they're not as separated as some people think. He writes in the book, "We needed technology to create art, and we needed art to imagine future technologies in both art and technology. There are people with the ambition to create, to help others see the world in a different way." It seems that Ethan and you, I think, as fuzzies, you know, what you call in the book, kind of a derogatory term for somebody who's non-technical, can more easily make that connection. And I think you make that connection with this fictional Yarbo. Josh, did you want to talk about that? It's described as an art tech collective in Oakland.
Yeah, so totally fictional art tech collective in Oakland. And it's comprised of these people who I want to marry the analog and digital. And this is probably coming from my like DIY experiences in Portland, in, you know, the early 2000s. Like, I love this. At Yarbo, they have like sewing machines next to these like big computers. You know, you're just kind of like, what are they doing? What's going on here? But I think Yarbo kind of represents this, like, you know, coming together of art and technology that, yeah, we can bring, I don't know, like plants and sewing machines in, and also computers and whatever robots, whatever else. And it exists, you know, intentionally in Oakland, so like not in San Francisco or down south in Silicon Valley. So it's kind of separate from mainstream tech. They don't have venture capitalists giving them money. And so I thought it was just kind of fun to play with that idea of like this art tech collective. Some of the people there have invented things like paint that changes based on your mood, you know, based on the viewer's mood.
And the never-ending churro.
A never-ending churro. And those things just kind of exist, and they're invented by these people at Yarbo. But though I don't think the people at Yarbo have much intention to sell and scale those products, and they're not in this, you know, mainstream Silicon Valley pipeline with venture capital and all of that. And so they just kind of like get to exist on their own. But for me, it was also kind of a commentary on what tech is considered important and what does get the funding and what does scale to millions of people.
I like the way you made that connection between art and technology. Both can be very creative fields.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I feel like coming from Portland, which again, it's very, you know, DIY, like chunk bike culture, and a liberal arts college like Reed, and then getting down to Silicon Valley, where I met a lot of people who are a lot more like business minded and probably like way more capitalist than I am. And yet they were some of the most creative people I've known. And so seeing that, like that creativity come through in a different way that wasn't writing novels or making paintings, but creating apps, was, I just found that really fascinating. And sometimes, like, you know, I live in San Francisco now, and it's disheartening, although understandable, to see this like clash between people who make art and tech bros, whatever. Because I think there's more commonality there than we sometimes see.
Now, one last question, Josh. You lived in Portland when you went to Reed. And as with many of us here, Powell's Books must have been this towering presence, not just a bookstore, but almost a religious experience for readers and writers. And you'll be appearing there on March 24th in conversation with Erica Berry, with your name on the marquee and everything. That has to be exciting.
It's really exciting. Yeah. I mean, I go to the downtown Powell's and just roam through the fiction section, you know, on weekends. And I lived near the Hawthorne Powell's for a while, and I used to go to the Fresh Pot, and, you know, they'd let you take the books from the store and kind of borrow them while you're at the
while you're having your coffee. Yeah.
Yeah. So I get like, you know, I swear it was like a $1 cup of coffee, which sounds made up now, but yeah, Powell's has been, you know, it's just such an institution. And it's surreal to think that I'm going to read there.
Well, Josh, I want to thank you for talking with me, and also thank you for the book. That Is All Good Fiction Does transported me to other worlds, a place you write in the book that seemed to float between reality and dream. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, I would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it if we had one. You could listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Josh Riedel, author of the new novel, Please Report Your Bug Here, from Henry Holt. Josh will be appearing at Powell's City of Books in conversation with Erica Berry on Friday, March 24th at 7 p.m. You can learn more about Josh, his work, and all his upcoming events online at joshriedel.com. Just a reminder that KBOO is in the middle of our winter membership drive. We're calling the drive All Thrills, No Frills, a tribute to the special programming you've come to expect from the station. from now through March 25th, we'll be asking you, our listeners, for your help. KBOO is true listener-sponsored community radio. We get 80% of our funding from our members, listeners like you. We wouldn't be on the air without you, and that's been the case since the station started broadcasting back in 1968. You can support programs like this and independent media by becoming a member today or renewing your membership. Just go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, March 23rd at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
it is time for us to adopt a new company brand to encompass everything that we do.